I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. Today, I'm joined by our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
And our editor at large, Jamie Graham.
Greetings.
Who also has an editor at large beard, a very large beard.
It is huge and it's only
fabulous.
Going to get bigger. Give me another 2 months. It's going to be down by my waist.
Wow.
Fabulous.
So we're not just talking about Jamie's beard this week. We're actually talking to Eddie Murphy and Wesley Snipes about Coming to America, the sequel to Coming to America. Said the same, but with a two in one. And we'll also be talking to the directors and writer of Raya and the Last Dragon. That's Don Hall and Carlos Lopez Estrada, as well as Qui Gwen. And we'll be reviewing both those films, as well as Amy Poehler's Moxie and Horror, The Columnist. Okay, so we've got a lot to get through, but before we do, let's do a very quick catch-up on WandaVision. Latest episode reaction in one word. Go, Jamie.
Necessary.
Lovely. Matthew?
Blimey.
Blimey, yes. Okay, so we won't go into that any further, but are you excited about the final ep coming up?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I'm hoping for some serious closure, but I suspect being Marvel, it will be open-ended and leave me wanting from Falcon, Winter Soldier and Loki.
Yeah, what an end credit scene.
End credits. Yeah. Okay.
They're the best bits.
Just to say, I've absolutely loved it, especially the first sort of half of it when it was all mystery and weird, and absolutely loved it.
Cool. Well, that is incoming. Let's get to what we can watch this week then. It's time to get the warm and fuzzies with this.
Prepare the royal jet. We are going back to America.
Oh, hell no, Your Majesty.
Come on! I'm back! Say it again! Feel right in this mother... Right. Feel good in this mother... Right. My whole hood in this mother...
Wow. So that's Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall in the long-awaited sequel Coming to America. But before we chat about the film, let's hear what Eddie and his co-star Wesley Snipes had to say about working together again. First up, here's our Hollywood correspondent Adam Tanswell catching up with Mr. Murphy.
Can we just start off with, why did it take so long to bring us a sequel to this movie?
Well, we had never planned on doing a sequel to the picture. The story kind of ended off in the original one, like, and they lived happily ever after. And we, you know, moved on to do other things. And then over the course of the next 25 years, the movie became this cult movie in the States anyway. I know on Halloween, people get dressed up as characters from the movie and little catchphrases from the movie kind of worked its way into the culture. Like, people say sexual chocolate and little things from the movie. One thing became really popular. People do the mic drop now and they do the thing, mic drop, drop the mic. The very first mic drop ever is Randy Watson in Coming to America. So it was all this stuff from the picture was floating around all the time. And it's on TV all the time. On Christmas, they played it 24 hours straight. Then I started getting the idea, like 25 years went by and it was like, hey, this movie is everywhere and people really like it. Maybe we could connect these dots. We could do a sequel to the picture. Then I got the idea how to connect the dots. And I was aware of how the movie had become a cult film and they had a bunch of fans that were really invested in it. They watched the movie all the time. So we had to make sure the script was airtight before we did it. So it took 4 years.
And how much has comedy changed in that time? How different is the approach to comedy in this movie? Were there things you couldn't do now that you did back then?
I don't feel like comedy has changed. If it's funny, it's funny. If I watch Chaplin or if I watch, you know, Buster Keaton or Harold Lloyd or the Three Stooges or old black and white stuff, it's always funny. And the times change and people's tastes change. We're going through a political correctness and people are a little more uptight right now than usual, but funny is still funny.
With that PC world, is it easier to offend people right now? Are you concerned about that or do you just let it fly?
Yeah, I don't even think about anything like that. You know, when I started on Saturday Night Live, and then I was a pretty controversial comedian in the early day in the 80s, my language and stuff like that. So that's always been in the background. It's not like it's a new thing, like, oh, people get offended easily. It's like that was always part of the equation for me.
And then just very quickly, can you take us on set and talk about working with Wesley Snipes? It's so fun to see.
We worked the first time in Dolomite Is My Name. And that's where I realized I wanted to do a bunch of movies with Wesley. We had really, really, really strong screen chemistry. Wesley is one of the best actors on earth and one of the most versatile actors on earth. Wesley started off doing mostly character acting, and he was amazing, and he did all different types of stuff. And then he became this big action movie star. And that's what people know him from, you know, Blade and the action movies. That's what people know him from. But I knew that he was super versatile. I remember Tu Wong Fu and White Men Can't Jump. Like, I knew about those movies. I remember all those movies. And like I said, when we worked together, it clicked. It was like, oh, I got this chemistry with him. I want to do other movies with him. So we went right into this picture. Now, I was the other day, I was trying to figure out, if I do Beverly Hills Cop, how can Wesley be in it?
Fantastic. Thank you, sir. Thank you.
And Eddie talked about his co-star there, Wesley Snipes. And here's what Wesley had to say about the experience when he chatted to Total Film's deputy editor, Matt Matum.
I'm delighted to welcome Wesley Snipes to Inside Total Film. Wesley, thanks very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure, my pleasure. I hope you enjoyed the film, has watched it, and the audience is going to have a hootin' good time, a hootin' laughin' good time.
On that note, firstly, for people who haven't seen the film yet, could you set up your character, General Izzy, and explain his connection to the 1988 film, please?
Well, the woman who was left at the altar, the beautiful woman who was left barking at the altar, was my sister, was General Easy's sister. And her big brother has had some issues with that for many, many years, 30 to be exact, and has decided that time is up. Enough is enough. There should have been a wedding. There should have been the unification of the nations and a consolidation of wealth and prosperity for both Zamunda and Next Doria. Unfortunately, they didn't understand this value. So he had to bring the militia. He had to bring the killers to emphasize, you know, the point.
You worked with director Craig Brewer and star Eddie Murphy on Dolomite Is My Name before this. And when they mentioned this role to you in this film, did you get a sense that it would have scene stealing potential?
Oh, no, you never know that. Yeah, but I knew I would have a lot of fun to get a chance to play off of Eddie once again and Arsenio this time. Mm. And remembering or recalling some of the great movies they've made where that camaraderie made cinematic magic. I wanted to experience that. So what you see is the actor who's really the fan having a great time.
And you actually auditioned for a role in the first film back in 1988, didn't you?
Yes, I auditioned for the love interest, Daryl, the Jerry Curled love interest. Yeah, and I didn't get the role. It was traumatic, quite devastating to my fragile artistic ego.
Did that affect your enjoyment of the film when you watched it? Kind of, were you thinking, ah, that should have been me there?
Just the other day, I felt the exact same thing. Exactly. I think I posted something like that, you know, I should have played that role.
Ultimately, do you think you got to have more fun as General Easy?
Most definitely. See, the good Lord had a better plan.
Did you kind of get the chance to sort of improv and riff much with Eddie and Arsenio in this
Absolutely
film?
Not. That was all scripted, actually. It's very Shakespearean. Our approach to it was very, very Shakespearean. No, we actually did a lot of, you know, playing with and building on the base, the good skeleton that was laid out by Craig Brewer and the wonderful writers of the film. You know, there's always the magic comes in allowing for spontaneity and improvisation. And that's been the key ingredient and the key element in the great Eddie Murphy films.
And obviously in Coming to America, Eddie's obviously brought you into a sequel from his back catalogue. If you could bring Eddie into a sequel from your back catalogue, what film would you choose that to be?
Maybe Demolition Man. Interesting. Yeah, I would say Demolition Man or Money Train. Yeah.
Could you see him as an ally of Simon Phoenix then?
Oh, definitely. Oh, definitely. I was, you know, I had thought of Eddie Murphy doing some action too, but Eddie told the second unit director and the choreographer, action choreographer on this film, like not to give him anything that they wouldn't give Morgan Freeman to do. That pretty much killed the whole action fantasy. Because he's not doing that.
And obviously, you've made a lot of action movies in your day. What is harder to you out of making a comedy film or an action film?
For me, action films are much harder. To move in character, to act in character, to play action in character. And the demand on the body, way more difficult than doing improvisational comedy. But, you know, I grew up in doing the comedy thing and the repertory theater thing. So I was quite comfortable and kind of raised in that environment with those rhythms and to be quick on your feet and, yeah, good at improvisation. So I'm very comfortable there. More so, I think that and dancing, I'm much more comfortable than even doing the martial arts.
What would you say was the toughest, the most physically tough action film you've done?
The one I did with Tommy Lee Jones. That film was quite physically challenging, you know, being in the swamps and all like that, and in the wheat container where we have this big fight. I caught an asthma attack, and that was a close one. It proved that, you know, action films ain't for everybody.
Another role you're obviously hugely well known for is Blade. The first film kind of almost set the ball rolling in terms of the wave of Marvel comic book movies. And I wondered, after that film, did you ever find yourself giving advice to anyone else who was taking on comic book movies after you?
Robert Downey and I, we had a conversation about, you know, him doing his role and the value of bringing acting skills to the party and characterization and how, what difference it would make. So there's something to it. You know, I think the growth in the franchise and the business is improved with inclusion of actors.
And kind of in terms of you sort of talking about your comedy and leaning into that side of it, how did your cameo in What We Do in the Shadows come about?
They were talking about, you know, the Daywalkers. Oh my gosh, one thing led to another, and Taika made it interesting for me. He was quite complimentary, and he made it interesting. You know, I had actually no idea there were so many fans of that show. I ended up taking my daughter on a college tour to see where she was going to go, and it happened to be in Fordham University here in New York City. And, you know, all of a sudden, some of the students came to the hallways, and they were like, you know, freaking out. And I figured, oh, this is a Blade moment, you know. And they were like, oh my God, we just saw it in the Shadows. I was like, really? Okay. We're a new audience. Who knew?
Just as one final thing, I wanted to ask, when I spoke to you recently, you told me an amazing anecdote about Sean Connery. But rather than getting you to repeat that, I wanted to ask about another legend and ask if you had any great stories about working with Robert De Niro.
Oh, well, the thing that I remember most about the first time working with De Niro was his style of shooting his coverage. He has a pattern of what we call the three doors in acting class, in acting training, is where you might say a phrase three different ways, three different intonations, three different emphasis on syllables or words. Christopher Walken is an excellent actor that plays with intonation and, you know, wordplay. And Robert does it while he's shooting his close-up. So the first scene that I had to shoot where I was off camera and I had to feed him the lines, he's doing what Robert does. And I'm under the impression that he's not hearing me. So I'm freaking out. I'm behind the camera and I was like, oh my God, I said it. I know I said it. And nobody seems to have a problem with it. But I'm personally inside just freaking out because I think Robert De Niro can't hear me give him his lines. And then I'm a scrub actor. I'm going to get fired.
So that's two Hollywood legends talking about the making of the movie. Matthew and Jamie, you've actually rewatched the first film this week. Does it stand up?
Yeah, it does. I haven't seen it for 30 years at least. And yeah, I was very pleasantly surprised how well it stands up. Yeah, it was just as funny as I remembered, just as sweet as I remembered. It's absolutely one of Eddie Murphy and John Landis's best films. So yeah, that was a real pleasure to revisit that one.
I'm the same. I hadn't seen it for at least 25 years. You know, I saw it in my youth, but some people hold it so dear and watch it again and again. And it wasn't one of those for me, so I couldn't remember much about it, but I thought it was really gentle and funny and sweet. And the main thing that stood out to me was Eddie Murphy, the charisma of that man. Just, you know, I tweeted this week, but was there a star in the 80s with more charisma? I mean, you got Nicholson and Cruz are up there, but Eddie Murphy in like 48 Hours, Beverly Hills Cop and this, it just radiates, absolutely radiates.
So you two probably would have loved to have seen Coming to the Number America, which we were promised links for so that you could watch them. Did you get those links?
No, not in time for this, sadly.
So sadly, you have been let down and you can't see it.
I haven't gone to America.
So because of that, I've seen it and I'm just going to give Matt Matem a call.
Hello.
And here he is.
So I've seen it twice.
You've seen it twice.
Oh. You've seen it twice.
Showing off. So Matt, tell us where we find Eddie this time around.
Okay, so we pick up in real time. So this is a good 30 something years after the last film. And we're in Zamunda, and Prince Akeem is kind of preparing to step up to the role of king. His father, Jaffe Jaffer, played by James L. Jones again, is kind of ailing, nearing his kind of deathbed time. And Akeem, as we find him now, he's got three daughters, so he hasn't actually sired a son. But we discover that back in 1988, he did actually father a son back in New York during his trip. And one of the best scenes in the film is we kind of get a digitally de-aged flashback finding out exactly what happened and how he did come to father this illegitimate son he's never known about. I think the film should have been called Coming to Zamunda to get rid of that awkward like number two in the middle. That would just make more sense as a title, because it's mostly set in Zamunda and it follows Lavelle, who is this long lost son played by Jermaine Fowler. And he's basically retrieved from New York and brought to Zamunda to kind of, you know, be prepared to inherit the throne as the kind of male heir. And it sort of goes from there, and we get this sort of reverse culture shock of the first film, which had this sort of pampered prince roughing it up in New York. This has the sort of streetwise New York guy getting all the benefits of palace life in Zamunda, basically, and trying to prove that he's the right fit to take on this mantle.
You said James L. Jones. Who else from the original cast comes back? Is it everybody? Or is that a spoiler?
Yeah, I don't know if it's a spoiler, but let's say a lot of people. Let's not say everybody, but a lot of people. Even the guy who works at McDowell's.
Yeah. But,
you know, the ginger guy. You know, the ginger guy.
He's really.
Yeah.
But he comes back.
I was sad that Eric LaSalle didn't return with his gold glow hair, because I loved him in the first film. But yeah, pretty much. I mean, you're going to get your fix of all the people you want to see again. And they all look great. What have they been doing? What vitamins are they all taking? Because they all look pretty good.
That's good to know.
How about tonally? Because the thing I like about the first one is it's quite gentle and sweet, you know, compared to something like 48 Hours, which I love, but it's quite raucous and Eddie on his sweary form. And this one is so kind of, just to use that word again, sweet. I mean, does the sequel have that as well, or does it change tonally?
I think it's one of those things that's sort of what was so successful about Bill and Ted Face the Music. They've really leaned into and tapped into the tone of that film and the heart of it and that sort of sweetness that comes with it that you're talking about. And yeah, for me, it really worked in a complete continuation. It's been modernized for modern day, so you get a lot more female empowerment, which you didn't really see in the first film, which would have been a criticism of mine. If you were to watch it now, you'd be like, well, why don't these women have any agency and why is it all led by the men? But you do see that. But at the same time, it's not snarky. It's got heart and it sort of feels tonally very much of the same world. And that's really successful, I think.
Yeah, because I had slightly more mixed feelings than Jane, perhaps. But Bill and Ted Face the Music is definitely the comparison that I would make, because it really sort of relies on your fondness for those characters and it really milks the nostalgia in the same way that did, while at the same time also it's kind of passing the baton on to this younger generation, mainly in terms of Lavelle, played by Jermaine Fowler, and Akeem's oldest daughter, Mika, played by Kiki Layne. They're the sort of young guard. Whilst I actually really like both of those, and Jermaine Fowler especially, I really thought he sort of demonstrated star potential in this role. He really, you know, maybe not 80s Eddie Murphy level, but he did have a lot of charisma, I thought. But I almost felt like sometimes the film was too much on them, when really from a sort of Coming to America sequel, you really just want as much Akeem and Semi, played by Arsenio Hall, as possible. And you do get Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall in a lot of different makeup guises again, you know, so there's fun to be had with that. But I almost feel like at times they feel like supporting characters almost. So that to me was a bit of a disappointment as someone who absolutely loves the original. That's what it's up there with like my all-time favorites. And I'm one of the people Jamie mentioned earlier who just kind of revisit it again and again and just absolutely love it. So,
but let's talk about other people that are newcomers to this. Somebody who really stole the show is Wesley Snipes, and he plays the king of the neighbouring country, Nextoria. Ha ha.
It's cool.
And brilliant. He is so good in this, isn't he? Didn't you love Wesley in this role?
He's very, very funny in this, and he does have a very funny connection to the first film as well. He's obviously, in some ways, he's the villain, but that's one of the things I liked about this film, and I feel like it's kind of landing at the right time in many ways, because, as Jane was saying, it's kind of gentle, it's easy to kind of feel sort of warm towards it with all the nostalgia and the sort of, you know, sweetness of it. There's no real kind of massive drama in it. There's a little bit of drama, obviously, as you need, but it's a very, very gentle, unstressful watch. So at times like these, it feels like it's kind of coming at the right time, you know, in very stressful times. It's just very, very easy to watch. Will it absolutely not replace the first one when I feel like, you know, there's no way people will be revisiting this in 30 years' time in the way that we still are with the 1988 film.
Well, a final question for me is just, does it work on its own? I mean, I don't imagine many people will watch it who haven't seen the first one, especially as it has the number two in its title. But if you just turn on Amazon Prime on Friday night and think, oh, what's this? Coming to America, I'll watch this. And you haven't seen the first one, does it work?
Hard for me to disentangle my love for the first film from that question, but I would say no. Probably because so many of the jokes are sort of callbacks to the first film, and so much does rely on that nostalgia. And again, pretty much all the jokes and stuff from the first film get some kind of version here. You know, any favorite moment is
barbershop.
I won't say what it is, but the bit that I found funniest is something that doesn't even exist within the film. It's something you kind of see in the end credits that's sort of, you know, outside of the world of the film, if that makes sense. But it's like a callback to something which I find absolutely hilarious in the first film. In some ways, maybe it's a bit damning on the film, but that was just the out and out funniest bit, this sort of random bit you get in the credits from a kind of cameo.
Yeah,
sort of
it's a cameo. And film, I think we can say it's a musical cameo. And I have to say that the musical portions of this film were the things that made me laugh the most. And there's this entire segment of the regal court in Zamunda and how people enter the court and the tunes that they enter to. And it's fabulous costumes and it's particular music that is played. That is very amusing. I don't want to do any spoilers, but it did make me chuckle so much. Also, it made me realize as well, when we sort of looked back to the old film and to look at this one, that, you know, Eddie Murphy said recently that before sort of Black Panther, this was the first sort of time in Coming to America that we'd seen this sort of very noble, very opulent kingdom of really can-do people who like have tons of natural resources and have this whole cultural thing. And so I loved the fact that that was sort of not po-faced, and the way that they come in with their regal tunes are very amusing.
But what you've all said have made me feel a bit better about it, because normally when journalists don't get sent links to things,
it's not a good sign.
Yeah, it's normally they're trying to hide it from you. So that's good that you two both liked it, especially you, Jane.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you want to see it this Friday with a takeaway and a glass of beer or wine, I think you won't be sorry. So, Matt, thank you for joining us, and we'll see you later.
Bye,
we're going to move on.
I decided long ago never to walk in anyone's shadow. If I fail, if I succeed, you can't take away my dignity. Because the greatest love of all is inside of me. Yeah. Sexy chocolate!
Okay, so let's go from one buddy movie to another.
Let's catch you up. My name is Raya. Our lands have been at war for as long as we can remember. Our people never see eye to eye.
My daughter, I believe our people can come together again, but someone has to take the first step.
Now, in order to restore peace, we must find the last dragon.
I wish to join this fellowship of butt-kickery.
Let's go.
So before we weigh in on Raya and the Last Dragon, let's hear from the co-directors, Don Hall and Carlos Lopez Estrada, and writer Qui Gwen, about the creation of a new kind of hero. Here's Matt Matem chatting with them.
So firstly, could I just ask you to set up this fantasy world of Kumandra for anyone who hasn't seen the film yet?
It's a fantasy world inspired by the many different cultures of Southeast Asia. It's a world that was at once unified and harmonious and built around the Dragon River, which is inspired by the Mekong River in Southeast Asia. And it's a world that was broken and fractured into five different lands that are very different. And it's a world built on distrust and disharmony. And it's a world that needs to be put back together and it needs to be unified. And that forms the basis of the entire story.
With dragons.
Exactly. One time there was a world full of dragons and the dragons sacrificed themselves for humanity. And also part of the film is about, you know, finding the last dragon to put the world back together.
And talking of the last dragon, Sisu is that last dragon of the title. And she isn't really like any dragon I've seen before on screen. So how did her design come about?
Well, Sisu is inspired by the Naga in Southeast Asian mythology. What we love about Sisu is the fact that she is a dragon unlike we have ever seen on screen. First of all, she's a water dragon. That connection comes from the Naga. And this means that she's connected to life. She's connected to harmony. She's also a creature of inspiration. So as opposed to many of the dragons that we have seen previously, particularly Western dragons that are threatening, that are monster-like creatures, Sisu is one that aims to bring people together and aims to inspire. And what's incredible at the movie is that we get to build a relationship with this dragon through Raya. So it's a really, really intimate look at what a human dragon relationship between someone from Earth and a divine being could look like.
Also, you get this kind of perfect meld of this character with Awkwafina's vocals. Like, how did Awkwafina kind of influence the character?
Well, I think none of our characters really become full until, you know, you marry it with, you know, the voice actor, right? And I think that the moment we got Awkwafina, like I think Don always says it, it's this perfect mixture of, you know, Southeast Asian mythology smashed in with this contemporary comedian, Awkwafina, who's already such a great performer, who's funny and dramatic, and in this movie, very, very inspiring. And cram those together, he inspired all of us to be able to craft and make this character that's so full of life. I always think that she's definitely the secret ingredient in what gives Sisu her soul.
And similarly, what qualities did Kelly Marie Tran have that made her right for Raya?
I mean, we can't speak enough about Kelly as a person, as a collaborator. You know, there could be a version of the Raya character, because essentially she's sort of a lone warrior on a quest that doesn't trust anybody and other than Tuk Tuk, her faithful steed. There is a version of that character that could be stoic and kind of laconic and a little dry. But you hire, you know, Kelly Marie Tran to come in, and now you've got wit and you've got buoyancy, you've got light mixed in there, and vulnerability, beautiful vulnerability. We can't say enough about her as a collaborator. She was absolutely critical to making this movie what it is. And not only that, but just as a human being, being such a joy to work with. I mean, she brought so much of herself to the character. There was a lot of joy on our part being able to work with her, but I also see a lot of joy within Kelly talking about the movie. And I think it means a great deal to her to be Raya.
And I also feel like we've never really seen a Disney character fight in the way that Raya does as well. Was that something you were kind of conscious that you were pushing the envelope in that way?
Well, the DNA of this movie is definitely an action movie, right? And so it's so fun to be able to do like a true blue like action movie. Disney movies are action movies with heart, sometimes songs. And in this one, we kind of really leaned into the action movie aspect, and not just with the fights, but with like, you know, the chases and the big adventure, like, you know, Indiana Jones escapes. It's like there's many different forms of action that happens in this, but particularly with the fights, it is something that I do appreciate as a martial artist myself.
How did you go about sort of staging that combat?
We knew from the beginning that there were going to be fight sequences, and we knew from the beginning the look of the movie that we'd been developing is so hyper-realist, is very, very cinematic. So we knew that the fights were going to have to reach that bar. Having Kui in our crew was essential because he, in addition to writing the thing, he was also one of our martial arts consultants. So he was very involved from day one and talking to the story artists, talking to the animators, bringing on all of his references to it.
It was just fun to be able to share like these martial arts I care so much about. It's, you know, the movie's inspired by Southeast Asian culture. So it was fun to share and make sure that the martial arts reflected those cultures, specifically Binjek Salat, Muay Thai, traditional Vietnamese wrestling, and Arnis. It was so fun to be able to bring weapons into the studio and go, hey, check these things out. Let's put these in the movie. So that was super fun. Kind of scary to carry weapons into Disney, though. You know, stage weapons, they were not sharp. So
we had a few sessions, Matt, where Kui, our fight choreographer, and then two fighters came on to present some of these routines in front of the entire crew. So we put, you know, a soft ground for them to fight on. They would bring all their weapons and they would just recreate it a few times for people to study, for people to look at. We filmed them. And then that's what we use in designing the actual movement. The animators reference all these sessions to make sure that the gravity felt right, that the body movement felt accurate. It was a bit like staging a live action fight, except that then it got interpreted by these incredible animators who were able to spice it up and add some like really cool flair to it.
Do you see this as a standalone film, or could you see yourselves exploring the world of Kumandra further, like in sequels down the line?
Well, I mean, we literally just finished it. So, you know, any thought of further adventures, you know, has definitely not been on our mind, just because it, you know, took everything we could to just to finish this thing. And, you know, obviously we've only scratched the surface of Kumandra. The world that has been designed and been thought through is huge and massive and epic in scale. And so could it contain more stories? Absolutely. But, you know, we wanted to just get the film done first, and then we'll, you know, discuss that later. Obviously, there's with Disney Plus, there's certainly a wide variety of types of stories that we can tell now that we have a distribution plan like Disney Plus. So we'll see.
We really want to do a cooking show with Benja on Disney Plus. So maybe that's the most obvious next way to
this is our pitch. This is where we're doing a pitch like this. We're just going, yeah, we're throwing it out there to the universe.
I would totally watch that. So thanks so much for your time today, guys. Really appreciate it, and huge congratulations on the film.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Oh, there goes Jean having a little opinion. Did Jean enjoy this film, Jamie?
Jean did love the film, actually, and I mean that genuinely, because he does watch telly. And whenever there's a dog on screen, he loves it. But he liked the dragons in this. There's a lot of kind of dragons near the end dancing in the sky and stuff. And he was quite enraptured by all of that.
Marvellous.
Oh, okay.
Let's just, in a nutshell, what are these dragons doing? And what is Raya doing with the dragons?
Essentially, it's a buddy movie between Raya and Sisu. They kind of form this classic Disney partnership and go off on many different travels. And there's lots of action, lots of humor, lots of chases, lots of intriguing developments. And it's lots of fun.
I know you're not a dog, Matthew, but what was so great about this?
I can't think of any other animated female buddy movie. I was trying to go through the whole canon of animated films. I can't think of any other film that's got two women together in a buddy movie. I mean, there's so many male ones, male and female ones like Moana, but yeah, this one, that's kind of groundbreaking.
Frozen.
To have that. Well, basically, but they're sisters, aren't they? So I don't know if they're buddies.
You're being very prescriptive. Yeah. But yes. But I mean, we can say that obviously, you know, this is a great film for, you know, little girls to watch, because the protagonist is a very capable girl. The baddie is a very capable girl. The dragon is a girl. And it's not made a big deal of. It's just that these are just capable people who happen to be women. And I found that really refreshing and exciting, and that they impressed everyone around them with their mad skills. And also, did you not think it was sort of, this must have been conceived long before COVID arrived, but it did feel like there was this weird link to our real world, in as much as this horrible disease thing, this dark cloud of horror is going around killing indiscriminately. And that it not only fractures families, it fractures communities and, you know, causes a escalation in xenophobia and all sorts of things. Obviously, that's making quite a big sort of link, but it does seem like it's exactly what we need, this lovely story about how, you know, trusting each other, respecting each other, coming together, working together is how we get through a bad time. Did you love it, Jamie?
I didn't love it as much as you two, but I did. Everything you said that you loved about it are the things I loved about it. I love the female buddy sort of side of it. I thought Sisu the dragon, although not an absolute classic Disney character like a Baloo or like, you know, just not Disney, but Toothless in How to Train Your Dragon. You know, I didn't think Sisu was on that level, but I did really like Sisu. And So there was loads I liked about it. The action scenes were great. The fight scenes were really punchy and dynamic with fast cutting and felt very kind of modern. The things I didn't like about it as much, it's all computer animated, and I do love old school Disney hand-drawn. I know we're kind of past that now, but I didn't feel it quite had the timeless classical quality of the best Disney films. It feels, you know, the dialogue feels very modern and is trying to be sort of on point with the kids today and all of that, and which is great right now. And I can understand, I appreciate that you've got to move with the times and that's what they're doing and making it for modern audiences. But I'm not sure it would be as timeless as the Disney films, you know, that we still go back and watch Snow White and Bambi and all of those. I don't know if it will live for 60, 70 years like those will.
I think that's a really weird thing to say, Jamie, because like by that criteria, you're like, oh, I think all films should be black and white and in Academy ratio, you know, I just don't think they're going to last. You're like, what's that about? That's such a weird thing to say. This is a really vibrant, beautifully made film. What difference does it make if it's in a computer or it's done by hand? I think that's weird. And I think the fact that it is incredibly modern, that makes it so refreshing. I mean, this, for me, Zizou sort of reminded me of Donkey in Shrek, that, you know, another great Eddie Murphy role. Yeah.
Genie and Aladdin.
The Aladdin genie, that this great comedic personality is just breathing real sort of sass into this role. I thought it was amazing. I can't see why that wouldn't be appreciated in years to come.
I don't know, maybe I just wasn't in the right mood for it, but it just felt a little bit too kinetic for me at times. You know, maybe I just wanted something a little bit more classical. But I'm going to say another weird thing now.
Oh, here we go.
Now that I've said that weird thing, but what it really reminded me of, Jane, you pointed out the pandemic and the ties to that, but it really reminded me of George Romero's zombie movies, which seems like a massive...
just perfect for the kids, that, right?
Stay with me. But I thought it was really bold for Disney in a way that the message of this film, or for most of this film, is that human beings on the whole are pretty terrible. They can't get on. And in Romero's zombie movies, it's not the zombies that kills everyone. It's ultimately the humans and the survivors, because they all kind of quarrel and squabble and they can't get on. They bring their own downfall. And in this, all through, you've got the five different tribes, and they just cannot get on. And they constantly cause problems for themselves and destruction. And it's only right at the end, when they finally learn to trust each other and to kind of have a bit of peace, that the message comes out, you know, that we've got to show some love and some understanding for each other. And I thought that was great. And it lands again at the perfect time, just as we go into a new presidency, you know, again, making a big leap here. But now that we've got sort of Harris and Biden, it just feels like this is a film where we've been through these turbulent last few years, and now is the time to kind of come out of it. So that was great.
Yeah, there's no flesh eating in this, though.
And the only weapons are just like really kick-ass, cool swords. Did you not love the sort of action? You know, it's sort of a bit like, it's Kung Fu Panda, which is one of my favorites, but also, you know, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and there's like the split screen and all of that. It just really, it's a visual feast. I thought it was just eye-poppingly beautiful.
In that vein, I think the one disappointment, well, for me, is that we couldn't get to see this on the big screen. I felt it lose something a little bit diminished. I mean, obviously that's because of current circumstances, but yeah, I would really have loved to have seen this on an IMAX screen. I think that would have really benefited, especially when you get those dragons with their incredible manes kind of swishing around, and like you say, all the action. So that was a bit of a shame for me.
What did you think about it not having any musical numbers? Did you like that or not like it?
I love not having kind of a musical number.
I like that as well. I can sense that you're expecting me to now have a go at that, and I'm not.
You'll be like, why didn't the dragon have like a show-stopping Gush for Berkeley?
Remake Pinocchio, that's what I want.
I mean, essentially, Jamie, this is you going back to like saying you just want a 1940s animation and that is all you want. You just want Disney to be stuck in a time warp doing like having a cricket singing.
Maybe it's because I've grown this big beard and I've turned into old father time or something. I'm just like stuck in the past. But no, like I said, there was a lot I liked about it. Everything you've mentioned, I did like. And I thought the fights were fantastic. I'm just projecting into the future, which is a silly thing to do because who knows. But I'm not sure in 50 years time it would be the classic Disney.
Oh, Gene.
He's disagreeing with me.
But I do have to say, Jamie, is film criticism about deciding whether films are going to be good in 50 years' time, or is it about does this film work for the now, which is what we're you know, talking about. This is available on Disney Plus this weekend.
It will be great, but two other little things I will point out. One, I think there's an awful lot of backstory to get through, and I'm thinking of nippers in the first sort of 10 minutes with the prologue. There's so much backstory. Will they go with that? And also, I think, again, for very young children, the fights are so dynamic and punchy that it may be a bit much. For me, this is kind of aimed more at maybe sort of 10, 12, even teenagers. What do you think?
I preferred Moana. I think Moana kind of plays better to all ages and does have a few musical numbers. Yeah, I kind of agree with that. Yeah, I think it will skew more sort of towards like the Studio Ghibli kind of audience, perhaps.
Yeah. The dragons really reminded me of Studio Ghibli. They felt more than even Disney, the design of them, which was wonderful.
Yeah,
I basically wanted a dragon. That was my takeaway from this. Mm. Where can I get me a water dragon? I like it. I'd like that in my house. My cat has died, my 15-year-old cat. Where can I adopt a water dragon? Please contact me on Twitter if you have one that needs a home.
Especially a water dragon as funny as Awkwafina, because she has some great lines when she first comes into the movie and she's really sort of fast talking. It was quite amusing.
She has beautiful hair.
This really noble dragon, majestic beast. And then she just pops up and starts like motor mouthing. It's great.
See, I think Jamie liked it more than he actually says. And I think he needs to watch it again.
I do like it. I would give it 4 stars out of 5. I'm just saying that for me, it's not an absolute classic. Like, it's got some 5-star reviews and people have said best Disney film of this century. And for me, I prefer Moana and I prefer Tangled. But I did like it a lot.
So on that note, that is Raya and the Last Dragon, which is available on Disney Plus this weekend. We highly recommend it. Okay, should we move on? Let's go to high school with Amy Poehler.
Hey, Mom, what do 16-year-olds care about?
When I was 16, all I cared about was smashing the patriarchy and burning it all down.
Oh, my God.
Girls constitute a revolution.
Did you hear rankings are already starting? Emma Cunningham's just going to get ranked most bangable for the second year in a row.
Kiara Pascal for best ass.
Caitlin Price, I'll take best rap.
It's so nice not to be on anyone's radar.
Totally.
This is Moxie, which is on Netflix now. Jamie, what is Moxie?
The Moxie is a high school movie directed by Amy Poehler. It's her second film. She did Wine Country a couple of years ago. And basically, it's about a 16-year-old girl called Vivian, who's played by Hadley Robinson, who just wants to kind of get through high school, keep her head down, you know, let's get on, get through this, get to college. And it's your typical kind of high school, but it's very male, sort of patriarchy, toxic masculinity, the football team, the quarterback, played by Patrick Schwarzenegger. And he really kind of leans into his family's, like, you know, elitism. So Vivian is trying to get through high school, keep her head down, and a new student starts called Lucy, who's played by Alicia Pascual Pina. And she's kind of just takes no nonsense. She's very empowered. She won't put up with any rubbish from Mitchell, the high school quarterback, who kind of rules the school and is the most popular kid. So she stands up to him. And then the annual list comes out that the football team always kind of published, which is horrendous, which is kind of listing all the girls in college, like who is the most bangable and horrible things like this. And it really toxic stuff. And the school always just accepts this and the girls kind of sigh and get on with it. But Lucy kind of says, what the hell is this? And really makes a point of it. Vivian then picks up on this and begins to get politicized. And Vivian's mum, who's played by Amy Poehler, back in her day when she was a teenager, she was, you know, she was really into kind of trying to topple the patriarchy and stand up for things. So Vivian takes a message from her mum and from this new girl at school and gets politicized and starts to publish a zine that she starts putting out in the girls' toilets. And all the girls start picking up and reading it and beginning to think, no, this isn't good enough, this culture of silence. We're going to stand up for ourselves. No one knows who's published this zine. It's like it's a big mystery. And then the movie rolls from there. And it's really about all the girls in this school beginning to stand up for themselves and beginning to kick back, really.
I mean, the one thing that it sort of reminded me of was Booksmart. It's very similar in that sort of tone and the celebration of friendship and sisterhood, that sort of idea that teenage women need to, you know, say enough is enough, because we do see this sort of thing everywhere. I mean, the Patrick Schwarzenegger character is particularly vile, but probably not particularly unique. And he is very good at playing an absolute douchebag and creepy to sort of watch, because you're just like, I can see dad in him. I can see his mum in him. But it's really light touch, isn't it? It's not being banged over the head with this. It's just, why would this not be the case? I really enjoyed it. Did you like it, Matthew?
I did, yeah. Like you said, it's like book smart. And there's also a reference in it to Mean Girls, and it reminded me quite a bit of that as well, which also obviously starred Amy Poehler. But I mean, it kind of tackles a few more serious issues, especially as it goes on. I kind of enjoyed the ensemble feel, and especially with, you get these kind of hapless teachers as well in the middle of it, with Marcia Gay Harden as the kind of embattled principal trying to maintain order while kind of also trying to listen to what her students want.
She doesn't listen though, does she? She's part of
that. No. And much as I really liked Hadley Robinson, but I kind of felt it should have had a bit more of an ensemble feel. So I felt like some of the supporting characters perhaps didn't get their due quite as much. They weren't quite as explored as much as they could have been. So perhaps, you know, maybe a longer film or just a bit more of an ensemble film. But yeah, I did enjoy it. It's very funny in places. It kind of knows when to be serious and when to be funny, when to kind of go for the comic relief. So it's very nice paced. Everyone in it is terrific. And the other thing I like working on a magazine, there's a lot of support for print media in it as well. You know, so I'm absolutely behind them all the way.
Women's empowerment and print. It's the great things in life. Jamie, what did you like about it?
So what I liked about it was what Matthew said, that it is dynamic and energetic and it's got a lightness of touch and it's funny. It's all of those things. But it really surprised me the places it goes. And I'm not going to spoil it here, but the more it goes on, and especially the last 20 minutes, it really gets into some quite dark subject matter, which kind of high school comedies or dramedies don't normally go to these places. And I think it went there, and it went there really well and potently, and handled it brilliantly in such a way that even though it's extremely serious, that it delivered real kind of punchy air moments of triumph. And I thought it was really good. I really like Moxie.
I also loved Pola. You know, she's playing the mum in this. I love watching her in anything. But, you know, the mum is equally having her own arc here with the man who gives her leeks for flowers. And I also love the soundtrack. I mean, there's a lot of quiet girl music in here.
Yeah, Bikini Kill.
It's really great. And that sort of celebrating that idea of that movement that sadly at our age is a generational thing and it could come back is really good. It's really fresh and funny and pertinent.
Yeah, I mean, I think it makes a kind of unofficial trilogy with Eighth Grade and Booksmart. This is like the third one, and they're all sort of similar, you know, about female stories and middle school, high school, and just done really well. And long may it continue, you know.
This is a mega run for me. I've loved every film we've talked about. So that is Moxie, which is available on Netflix now. And honestly, you want to get yourself a takeaway for that one and really enjoy it. It's for everybody. Finally, let's get even with social trolls, shall we? With this.
Ik heb ook wel een uitlaatklep hoor.
Wat dan?
Zijn. Waarom kunnen wij niet gewoon vriendelijk van mening verschillen?
Je hebt de verkeerde kuthoer genoemd.
Wat het ook is. Ik kan het vertellen.
So this is The Columnist. Matthew, who is getting even with the trolls in this?
Oh yes, The Columnist of the title is a columnist called Femke Boot, played by Katja Herbers. And she's working on a book. She's struggling to get this finished. At the same time, she's being endlessly trolled online with these really vile, hideous comments about everything she does and writes. She's getting this relentless harassment. And then one day she realizes that one of her online persecutors is actually one of her neighbors, who seems quite pleasant on the surface, but obviously has this very kind of these dark opinions that he's sharing online. And one day she's pushed too far and she kills him and she takes his middle finger. And then once she started this ball rolling, she carries on. She kind of goes on a bit of a rampage of revenge all the while kind of working on her book and developing a relationship. She's got a daughter as well, so she's kind of taking care of all these things. And then obviously things kind of develop and the police start to get wind of something going on. Probably I won't say too much more, but everything comes to a head eventually. And there's lots of comedy, lots of horror. And it's also kind of in the vein of something like, well, I suppose the classic example is Theatre Falling Down.
Oh, I was thinking Theatre of Blood with the killing of the critics.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, that kind of falling down mentality where a person is just pushed too far and kind of goes beyond society's bounds and we follow them. They're kind of protagonist and antagonist at the same time. So it's kind of testing our sympathies along the way.
It's quite a blunt instrument in the message it has, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing really subtle about this. There's speeches that she gives her victims about how she is a real person and you can't just call people horrible female insulting things and you can't call them paedophiles and you can't just wreck people's lives from your keyboard without any understanding that they are real people.
Yeah.
Is it too blunt? Does it work, Jamie?
I agree that it's a little bit blunt, that she tends to, when she tracks these trolls down, she always says, like, why can't you be nice? You know, maybe a smarter film would have dug into, you know, why we have so many trolls and toxic masculinity and all of that and, you know, got behind the reasons for it. And it doesn't go as deep as it can. But despite that, I do think it's just a really sort of pacey, enjoyable black comedy, like horror comedy. And there was a lot I liked about it. I think the lead actress, Katya Herbers, is wonderful. And the way she kills people is quite inventive and nasty in a fun way. You know, it's one of those films where when the blood sort of splatters rather than be absolutely revolting, it kind of makes you cheer. And, you know, I enjoyed it. I think it's good. Yeah, I would recommend it.
She reminded me sort of facially of Carey Mulligan. And actually, the film reminded me of Promising Young Woman in this idea of a woman just saying enough is enough and taking, you know, matters into her own hands and the sort of moral murkiness of that and whether that makes you as bad as the perpetrators or this sort of avenging angel and that discussion that can be had there. And also I could sort of imagine this being remade. This is obviously a Dutch film. And I could imagine this being remade in a more sort of lurid fashion by Hollywood because it is sort of intriguing. And as you say, you feel like you want to cheer when, you know, keyboard warriors get their comeuppance, especially when it's with their sausage frying pan. The problem I had with it, and it was this weird thing, I didn't know where it existed because all the time I was saying, well, she's put her fingerprints all over that. She's taken that finger. Why would the police not come if this noise was being made next door in your flat? Surely somebody's CCTV has seen this. She's just driven there and left her car. That distracted me because it seemed to operate in a fantasy world. And so by the end, I have to admit, I didn't know if she'd actually done it or if this was all imagined as part of the writer's block and the trying to find a muse to her new book. So I think you could probably read it as perhaps not real. What do you think?
I think you could definitely read it as one big revenge fantasy. All those points you've made, I think they're kind of deliberate, but it does operate in this kind of heightened, stylized world. And, you know, it makes no sense if you begin to pick it apart, you know, she'd be caught immediately.
Yes.
I don't think it's going for that realism. I think it is, you know, it's a sort of heightened black comedy and maybe it is all happening in her head.
Yeah. I think it's a little American Psycho for female writers. And obviously, I'm down with that. I'm down with having fantasies in your head about that. I mean, this is also, you know, sits well with Moxie as well, because this is also about, you know, there's this secondary story of the daughter who is being sort of told she can't have freedom of speech at school and she's not allowed to challenge her patriarchal headmaster. So there's that sort of element going on as well. There's lots of stuff going on with it. It just didn't quite grab me, I don't think.
I think I liked it more than you, Jane. And I do think, like you said, I can see it being remade. It's kind of played the festival circuit. It was at Fright Fest last year and got really good reviews. And I think it's won a couple of awards. I think I'm right in saying that. And I can see it definitely getting the attention that it gets a remake and maybe put a Hollywood star in there, like a Charlize Theron or someone to go and kick some ass.
Yeah, she would be good. Okay, so we're recommending this. This is available on all digital platforms from this Friday. Let us know if you think it's all in her head. or not. Okay, so that's it. This has been a busy one. But before we go, we do have a reader's question. Are you ready? What's one of your pet peeves that movie characters do, but real people don't?
Only one. Am I only allowed to pick one? There's so many.
I know, there's so many of these like things, but you know, I mean, what really gets you going?
Number one has to be phone etiquette. People not saying hello, please may I speak to, or saying goodbye at the end of calls. It's just launching straight in. Have you got the plans? See you eight.
And no one says, who is this? Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. Or I can't hear you, or you know, I've got bad signal.
Oh, hang on, my signal's terrible. Let me move in the other
way. Yeah, unless it's relevant to the plot. And no one charges their phones ever. Like, I really enjoyed Greenland the other week, but they never charge their phones. They're just kind of going on for days and days. You never see anyone plug in their phone.
Yeah, you never see anyone hunting for a socket, do you?
No.
Amy, what's your pet peeve?
My pet peeve, and it's probably because I'm a bit rubbish with chopsticks. I can just about use them. I'm not very graceful. And my pet peeve is every single American film when they eat Chinese food, and they do it a lot. They're always getting takeout in those boxes where they just sort of lift the flaps open and they get out their chopsticks, and every single American is just brilliant with chopsticks. They just boom, boom, start spooning it down. I don't think I have ever seen an American movie where someone struggles a bit or just goes, sod this, I'm getting a fork. You know?
Yeah.
It just really bugs me. Once you start to notice it, that's it. You know, there's several a year. Let us know, anyone listening to this, if you've ever seen an American character struggle with chopsticks.
There you go. There's a challenge. Mine's food related as well. And it's something that I share a frustration with Bryan Cranston, who we interviewed a couple of issues ago, who also has this peeve that people don't eat food in movies. They push stuff around a plate or they come in for breakfast and the mum's laid out a breakfast and they eat a bite of egg and then leave the rest of my mum would go ballistic if she'd made a breakfast for me and I just walked out without eating it. They go to dinner and they just like shove some things around on a plate. And Cranston, it's one of his peeves because he thinks it's just really irritating and not realistic. So he always doesn't eat his lunch on a set if he knows he's doing a food scene, and he scarfs it down. If you're ever watching Bryan Cranston eating anything in a film, you'll know
it's for real.
That man is eating it properly and he's chewing
so
it and
dedicated.
Swallowing it, and he's eating entire meals because he thinks that's what you should do in a film. And I agree. Well done, Brian.
It's funny you should say that because I saw a tweet this week and I don't know who tweeted it, but someone said they have never seen Tom Cruise eat in a movie. You know, he's done God knows how many movies, 60 movies. And they were saying, have you ever seen Tom Cruise eat in a movie? And I think one person replied with one example where he put something in his mouth and spat it out, and that was it. But no one has ever seen him like chew and swallow food. I mean, I'm a big Tom Cruise fan. I can't think of any.
So I want to see a dinner scene with Bryan Cranston and Tom Cruise there so that we
that
can just enjoy Cranston scarfing it down and Cruise not eating at all.
In the Ocean's movie, isn't it the running gag that Brad Pitt is eating in every single scene? He's always shoveling something
in his mouth. Rusty.
The opposite.
Always eating.
Yeah.
I watched a movie this week. I can't remember what it was because I've watched several, but exactly what you said, Jane, it bugged me so much. A man and a woman went out for dinner to a diner on a date. They sat down, they both ordered a burger and chips. They had a conversation and they left and they didn't even take one bite, not even a cursory nibble.
God, wouldn't you say, can I get this to go? You know, if you desperately have to go, get that in a baggie.
And who would drop like $20 on their meal and just go? Well, I mean, what do they do? Yeah. Get home and then have some toast or something? It's ridiculous.
Food in movies is really annoying. Yeah. Do let us know what your annoying pet peeves are. Also, if you've seen Tom Cruise eating anything in a movie, you can find us on Twitter. But for now, I think we'll say goodbye.
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 Goodbye.